touched Kirsten's arm as he passed. Better keep moving, Kiki. So you wouldn't advise coming back here, the conductor said. The last caravan was passing. Said, bringing up the rear, seized Kirsten's shoulder and propelled her along the road. How much danger do you want to put yourself in? He hissed. Keep walking. Don't tell me what to do. Then don't be an idiot. Will you take me with you? Kirsten heard the boy ask. The conductor said something she couldn't hear, and when she looked back, the boy was staring after the departing symphony, his squirrel forgotten at the end of the stick. The night cooled as they left St. Deborah by the water. The only sounds were the clomping of horseshoes on cracked pavement, the creaking of the caravans, the footsteps of the symphony as they walked, small rustlings from the night forest. A fragrance of pine and wildflowers and grass in the air, the stars so bright that the caravans cast lurching shadows on the road. They'd left so quickly that they were all still in their costumes, Kirsten holding up her Titania dress so as not to trip over it, and Said a strange vision in his Oberon tuxedo, the white of his shirt flashing when he turned to look back. Kirsten passed him to speak with the conductor, who walked, as always, by the first caravan. What did you tell the boy by the road? That we couldn't risk the perception of kidnapping, the conductor said. What did the prophet say to you after the concert? The conductor glanced over her shoulder. You'll keep this to yourself? I'll probably tell August. Of course you will. But no one else? Okay, Kirsten said. No one else. He suggested that we consider leaving Alexandra as a guarantee of future good relations between the symphony and the town. Leaving her? Why would we? He said he's looking for another bride. Kirsten dropped back to tell August, who swore softly and shook his head. Alexandra was walking by the third caravan, oblivious, looking up at the stars. Sometime after midnight, the symphony stopped to rest. Kirsten threw the Titania gown into the back of a caravan and changed into the dress she always wore in hot weather, soft cotton with patches here and there, the reassuring weight of knives on her belt. Jackson and the second oboe took two of the horses and rode back along the road for a mile, returned to report that no one seemed to be following. The conductor was studying a map with a few of the older symphony members in the moonlight. Their flight had taken them in an awkward direction, south down the eastern shore of Lake Michigan. The only reasonably direct routes to their usual territory took them either back through St. Deborah by the water or close by a town that had been known to shoot outsiders on sight, or inland through a wilderness that in the pre-collapse era had been designated a national forest. What do we know about this particular national forest? The conductor was frowning at the map. I vote against it, the tuba said. I know a trader who went through there. Said it was a burnt-out area, no towns, violent ferals in the woods. Charming. And the south, along the lakeshore? Nothing, Dieter said. I talked to someone who'd been down there, but this was maybe 10 years ago. Said it was sparsely populated, but I don't remember the details. 10 years ago, the conductor said. Like I said, nothing. But look, if we keep going south, we'll eventually have to turn inland anyway, unless you're especially eager to see what became of Chicago. Did you hear that story about snipers in the Sears Tower? The first cello asked. I lived that story, Gil said. Wasn't there supposed to be a population to the south of here, down by Severn City? A settlement in the former airport, if I'm remembering correctly. I've heard that rumor, too. It wasn't like the conductor to hesitate, but she studied the map for some time before she spoke again. We've talked about expanding our territory for years, haven't we? It's a risk, Dieter said. Being alive is a risk. She folded the map. I'm missing two symphony members, and I still think they went south. If there's a population in Severn City, perhaps they'll know the best route back to our usual territory. We continue south along the lakeshore. Kirsten climbed up to the driver's seat on the second caravan to drink some water and to rest. She shrugged her backpack from her shoulders. Her backpack was child size, red canvas with a cracked and faded image of Spider-Man, and in it she carried as little as possible. 2 glass bottles of water that in a previous civilization had held Lipton iced tea, a sweater, a rag she tied over her face in dusty houses, a twist of wire for picking locks, the Ziploc bag that held her tabloid collection and the Dr. Eleven comics, and a paperweight. The paperweight was a smooth lump of glass with storm clouds in it, about the size of a plum. It was of no practical use whatsoever, nothing but dead weight in the bag, but she found it beautiful. A woman had given it to her just before the collapse, but she couldn't remember the woman's name. Kirsten held it in the palm of her hand for a moment before she turned to her collection. She liked to look through the clippings sometimes, a steadying habit. These images from the shadow world, the time before the Georgia flu, indistinct in the moonlight, but she'd memorized the details of every one. Arthur Leander and his second wife, Elizabeth, on a restaurant patio with Tyler, their infant son. Arthur with his third wife, Lydia, a few months later. Arthur with Tyler at LAX. An older picture that she'd found in an attic stuffed with 3 decades' worth of gossip magazines, taken before she was born. Arthur with his arm around the pale girl with dark curls who would soon become his first wife, caught by a photographer as they stepped out of a restaurant, the girl inscrutable behind sunglasses, and Arthur blinded by the flash. Part 3. I Prefer You with a Crown. Chapter 13. The photo from the tabloid. 10 minutes before the photograph, Arthur Leander and the girl are waiting by the coat check in a restaurant in Toronto. This is well before the Georgia flu. Civilization won't collapse for another 14 years. Arthur has been filming a period drama all week, partly on a soundstage and partly in a park on the edge of the city. Earlier in the day he was wearing a crown, but now he's wearing a Toronto Blue Jays cap that makes him look very ordinary. He is 36 years old. "What are you going to do?" he asks. "I'm going to leave him." The girl, Miranda, has a recent bruise on her face. They're speaking in whispers to avoid being overheard by the restaurant staff. He nods. "Good." He's looking at the bruise, which Miranda hasn't been entirely successful in concealing with makeup. "I was hoping you'd say that. What do you need?"
"I don't know," she says. "I'm sorry about all this. I just can't go home."
"I have a suggestion."
He stops because the coat check girl has returned with their coats. Arthur's is magnificent, smooth and expensive-looking. Miranda's a battered peacoat that she found in a thrift store for $10. She turns her back on the restaurant as she puts it on in an effort to hide the torn lining. When she turns back, something in the hostess's smile suggests that this effort was in vain, while Arthur, who by this point in his life is extravagantly famous, flashes his best smile and palms a 20 to the coat check girl. The hostess is surreptitiously hitting send on a text to a photographer who gave her $50 earlier. Outside on the sidewalk, the photographer reads the message on his phone. "Leaving now." "As I was saying," Arthur murmurs, close to Miranda's ear, "I think you should come stay with me."
"At the hotel? I can't," Miranda whispers.
"I insist. No strings attached."
Miranda is momentarily distracted by the coat check girl, who is staring adoringly at Arthur. He whispers,
"You don't have to make any decisions right away. It's just a place you can stay, if you'd like."
Miranda's eyes fill with tears.
"I don't know what to..."
"Just say yes, Miranda."
"Yes. Thank you."
It occurs to her as the hostess opens the door for them that she must look terrible, the bruise on her face and her eyes red and watery. "Wait," she says, fishing in her handbag.
"I'm sorry, just a second."
She puts on the enormous sunglasses she'd been wearing earlier in the day. Arthur puts his arm around her shoulders, the photographer on the sidewalk raises his camera, and they step out into the blinding flash.
So, Arthur.
The journalist is beautiful in the manner of people who spend an immense amount of money on personal maintenance. She has professionally refined pores and a $400 haircut, impeccable makeup, and tastefully polished nails. When she smiles, Arthur is distracted by the unnatural whiteness of her teeth, although he's been in Hollywood for years and should be used to it by now.
Tell us about this mystery brunette we've been seeing you with.
I think that mystery brunette has a right to her privacy, don't you? Arthur's smile is calibrated to diffuse the remark and render it charming.
Won't you tell us anything at all about her? Just a hint?
She's from my hometown, he says, and winks. It's not a hometown, actually. It's a home island. It's the same size and shape as Manhattan, Arthur tells people at parties all his life, except with 1,000 people. Delano Island is between Vancouver Island and mainland British Columbia, a straight shot north from Los Angeles. The island is all temperate rainforest and rocky beaches, deer breaking into vegetable gardens and leaping in front of windshields, moss on low-hanging branches, the sighing of wind in cedar trees. In the middle of the island, there's a small lake that Arthur always imagined was formed by an asteroid, almost perfectly round and very deep. One summer, a young woman from somewhere else committed suicide there, left her car parked up on the road with a note, and walked into the water. And then when divers went after her, they couldn't find the bottom of the lake, or so local children whispered to one another, half frightened, half thrilled. Although upon reflection, years later, the idea of a lake so deep that divers can't reach bottom seems improbable. Still, the fact is that a woman walked into a lake that wasn't large, and no one found the body for 2 weeks despite intensive searching, and the episode sparks up against Arthur's childhood memories retrospectively and leaves a frisson of darkness that wasn't there at the time. Because actually, from day to day, it's just a lake, just his favorite place to swim, everyone's favorite place to swim because the ocean is always freezing. In Arthur's memories of the lake, his mother is reading a book under the trees on the shore, while his little brother splashes around with water wings in the shallows, and bugs land fleetingly on the water's surface. For unknown reasons, there is a naked Barbie doll buried up to her waist in the dirt on the lake road. There are children on the island who go barefoot all summer and wear feathers in their hair. The Volkswagen vans in which their parents arrived in the 70s turning to rust in the forest. Every year there are approximately 200 days of rain. There's a village of sorts by the ferry terminal, a general store with one gas pump, a health food store, a real estate office, an elementary school with 60 students, a community hall with two massive carved mermaids holding hands to form an archway over the front door, and a tiny library attached. The rest of the island is mostly rock and forest, narrow roads with dirt driveways disappearing into the trees. In other words, it's the kind of place that practically no one Arthur encounters in New York, Toronto, or Los Angeles can fathom, and he gets a lot of uncomprehending stares when he talks about it. He is forever trying to describe this place and resorting to generalizations about beaches and plant life. The ferns were up to my head, he tells people, performing a gesture that suggests greater and greater height over the years, until he realizes at some point in his mid-40s that he's describing plants that stand 7 or 8 feet tall. Just unbelievable in retrospect. It must have been so beautiful, is the inevitable reply. It was, he tells them. It is. And then finds a way to change the subject, because it's difficult to explain this next part. Yes, it was beautiful. It was the most beautiful place I have ever seen. It was gorgeous and claustrophobic. I loved it, and I always wanted to escape.
At 17, he's accepted into the University of Toronto. He fills out the student loan applications, his parents scrape up the money for the plane ticket, and he's gone. He thought he wanted to study economics, but when he arrives in Toronto, he discovers that he wants to do almost anything else. He worked hard in high school, but he's an indifferent student at the university. The classes are tedious. The point of coming to this city wasn't school, he decides. School was just his method of escape. The point was the city of Toronto itself. Within 4 months, he's dropped out and is going to acting auditions, because some girl in his Commerce 101 class told him he should be an actor. His parents are horrified. There are tearful phone calls on calling cards late at night. The point was to get off the island, he tells them. But this doesn't help, because they love the island, and they live there on purpose. But 2 months after leaving school, he gets a bit part in an American movie filming locally, and then a one-line role in a Canadian TV show. He doesn't feel that he really has any idea how to act, so he starts spending all his money on acting classes, where he meets his best friend, Clark. There is a magnificent year when they are inseparable and go out 4 nights a week with fake IDs, and then, when both of them are 19, Clark succumbs to parental pressure and returns to England for university, while Arthur auditions successfully for a theater school in New York City, where he works for cash in a restaurant and lives with 4 roommates above a bakery in Queens. He graduates from the theater school and marks time for a while, auditioning and working long hours as a waiter, then a job on Law and Order. Is there an actor in New York who hasn't worked on Law and Order? That lands him an agent and turns into a recurring role on a different Law and Order, one of the spin-offs. A couple of commercials, 2 television pilots that don't get picked up, but you should totally come out to L.A., the director of the second one says when he calls Arthur with the bad news. Crash in my guest house for a few weeks, do some auditions, see what happens. And Arthur's sick of Eastern winters by then, so he does it. He gets rid of most of his belongings and boards a westbound plane. In Hollywood, he goes to parties and lands a small part in a movie, a soldier with 3 lines who gets blown up in the first 10 minutes. But this leads to a much bigger movie part, and this is when the parties begin in earnest. Cocaine and smooth girls with perfect skin in houses and hotel rooms, a number of years that come back to him later in strobe-like flashes. Sitting by a pool in Malibu, drinking vodka and talking to a girl who says she came here illegally from Mexico, crossed the border lying under a load of chili peppers in the back of a truck when she was 10. He's not sure whether to believe her, but he thinks she's beautiful. So he kisses her, and she says she'll call, but he never sees her again. Driving in the hills with friends, a passenger in a convertible with the top down, his friends singing along with the radio, while Arthur watches the palm trees slipping past overhead. Dancing with a girl to Don't Stop Believin', secretly his favorite song, in some guy's basement tiki bar, and then it seems like a miracle when he sees her at someone else's party a week later. The same girl at 2 parties in this infinite city. She smiles at him with half-closed eyes and takes his hand, leads him out to the backyard to watch the sunrise over Los Angeles. The novelty of this town is starting to wear a little thin by then, but up there by Mulholland Drive he understands that there's still some mystery here, still something in this city he hasn't seen. A sea of lights fading out in the valley as the sun rises, the way she runs her fingernails lightly over the skin of his arm. I love this place, he says. But 6 months later, when they're breaking up, she throws the line back at him. You love this place, but you'll never belong here, and you'll never be cast as the lead in any of your stupid movies. And by this point he's 28, time speeding up in a way that disconcerts him, the party's going too late and getting too sloppy, waiting in the ER on 2 separate occasions for news of friends who've OD'd on exotic combinations of alcohol and prescription medications, the same people at party after party, the sun rising on scenes of tedious debauchery, everyone looking a little undone. Just after his 29th birthday, he lands the lead in a low-budget film about a botched bank robbery and is pleased to learn that it's filming in Toronto.
He likes the idea of returning to Canada in triumph, which, he's aware, is egotistical. But what can you do? Arthur's mother calls one night and asks if he remembers Susie, that woman who was a waitress at the General Store Cafe when he was a kid. Of course he remembers Susie. He has vivid memories of Susie serving him pancakes in the cafe. Anyway, Susie's niece came to live with her a few years back, for reasons that remain buried despite the dedicated excavation efforts of every gossip on the island. The niece, Miranda, is 17 now, and just very driven, very together. She recently moved to Toronto to go to art school, and could Arthur maybe take her to lunch? Why? He asks. We don't know each other. She's a 17-year-old girl. It'll be kind of awkward, won't it? He hates awkwardness and goes to great lengths to avoid it. You have a lot in common, his mother says. You both skipped a grade in school. I'm not sure that qualifies as a lot. But even as he says this, he finds himself thinking, she'll know where I'm from. Arthur lives in a permanent state of disorientation, like a low-grade fever, the question hanging over everything being, how did I get from there to here? And there are moments, at parties in Toronto, in Los Angeles, in New York, when he'll be telling people about Delano Island, and he'll notice a certain look on their faces, interested but a little incredulous, like he's describing an upbringing on the surface of Mars. For obvious reasons, very few people have heard of Delano Island. When he tells people in Toronto that he's from British Columbia, they'll invariably say something about how they like Vancouver, as though that glass city 4 hours and 2 ferries to the southeast of his childhood home has anything to do with the island where he grew up. On 2 separate occasions, he's told people in Los Angeles that he's from Canada, and they've asked about igloos. An allegedly well-educated New Yorker once listened carefully to his explanation of where he's from, southwestern British Columbia, an island between Vancouver Island and the mainland, and then asked, apparently in all seriousness, if this means he grew up near Maine. Call Miranda, his mother says. It's just lunch. Miranda at 17. She is preternaturally composed and very pretty, pale with gray eyes and dark curls. She comes into the restaurant in a rush of cold air, January clinging to her hair and her coat, and Arthur is struck immediately by her poise. She seems much older than her age. How do you like Toronto? Arthur asks. Not merely pretty, he decides. She is actually beautiful. But it's a subtle kind of beauty that takes some time to make itself apparent. She is the opposite of the L.A. girls with their blonde hair and tight T-shirts and tans. I love it. The revelation of privacy. She can walk down the street and absolutely no one knows who she is. It's possible that no one who didn't grow up in a small place can understand how beautiful this is, how the anonymity of city life feels like freedom. She starts telling him about her boyfriend, Pablo, also an artist, and Arthur forces himself to smile as he listens. She's so young, he tells himself. She's tired of talking about herself and asks about him, and he tries to explain the surrealism of this world he's stepped into, where people know him when he doesn't know them. He talks about how much he loves Los Angeles and how simultaneously the place exhausts him, how disoriented he feels when he thinks about Delano Island and compares it to his current life. She's never been to the United States, although she's lived within 200 miles of the border all her life. He can see that she's straining to imagine his life there, her thoughts probably a collage of scenes from movies and magazine shoots. You love acting, don't you? Yes, usually I do. What a wonderful thing. To get paid for doing what you love, she says, and he agrees with this. At the end of the meal, she thanks him for paying the check, and they leave together. Outside, the air is cold, sunlight on dirty snow. Later, he'll remember this as a golden period, when they could walk out of restaurants together without anyone taking pictures of them on the sidewalk. Good luck on the movie, she says, boarding a streetcar. Good luck in Toronto, he replies, but she's already gone. In the years that follow, he's often successful at putting her out of his mind. She is far away and very young. There are a number of movies, an 18-month relocation to New York for a Mamet play, back to Los Angeles for a recurring role in an HBO series. He dates other women, some actresses, some not, two of them so famous that they can't go out in public without attracting photographers who swarm like mosquitoes. By the time he returns to Toronto for another movie, he can't go out in public without being photographed either, partly because the movie parts have gotten much bigger and more impressive, partly because the photographers got used to taking his picture when he was holding hands with more famous people. His agent congratulates him on his dating strategy. I wasn't being strategic, Arthur says. I dated them because I liked them. Sure you did, his agent says. I'm just saying, it didn't hurt. Did he actually date those women because he liked them? Or was his career in the back of his mind the whole time? The question is unexpectedly haunting. Arthur is 36 now, which makes Miranda 24. He is becoming extremely, unpleasantly, famous. He wasn't expecting fame, although he secretly longed for it in his 20s, just like everyone else. And now that he has it, he's not sure what to do with it. It's mostly embarrassing. He checks into the Hotel Le Germain in Toronto, for example, and the young woman at the registration desk tells him what an honor it is to have him staying with them. And if you don't mind me saying so, I adored that detective film. And as always in these situations, he isn't sure what to say. He honestly can't tell if she really did enjoy the detective film, or if she's just being nice, or if she wants to sleep with him, or some combination of the above. So he smiles and thanks her, flustered and not sure where to look, takes the key card and feels her gaze on his back as he walks to the elevators, trying to look purposeful, also trying to convey the impression that he hasn't noticed and doesn't care that half the population of the lobby is staring at him. Once in the room, he sits on the bed, relieved to be alone and unlooked at, but feeling, as he always does in these moments, a little disoriented, obscurely deflated, a bit at a loss. And then, all at once, he knows what to do. He calls the cell number that he's been saving all these years. Chapter 14. Miranda is at work when Arthur Leander calls her again. She's an administrative assistant at a shipping company, Neptune Logistics, where she spends quiet days at a desk shaped like a horseshoe in a private reception area outside her boss's office door. Her boss is a young executive named Leon Prevant, and his door is almost always closed because he's almost always out of town. There are acres of gray carpeting and a wall of glass with a view of Lake Ontario near her desk. There's rarely enough work to keep her occupied for more than an hour or two at a time, which means she can often spend entire afternoons sketching. She's working on a series of graphic novels, with long coffee breaks, during which she likes to stand by the glass wall and look out at the lake. When she stands here, she feels suspended, floating over the city. The stillness of the water, the horizon framed by other glass towers and miniature boats drifting in the distance. A soft chime signifies an incoming email. During the long period when her position was staffed by an incompetent temp, the winter of our discontent, Leon Prevant calls it, Leon took to outsourcing his travel planning to his subordinate Hannah's administrative assistant, Thea, who is impeccable in a smooth corporate way that Miranda admires, and who has just forwarded Leon's flight confirmation emails for next month's trip to Tokyo. In Thea's presence, she feels ragged and unkempt, curls sticking up in all directions, while Thea's hair is glossy and precise. Her clothes never quite right, whereas Thea's clothes are perfect. Miranda's lipstick is always too gaudy or too dark, her heels too high or too low. Her stockings all have holes in the feet and have to be worn strategically with specific pairs of shoes. The shoes have scuffed heels, filled in carefully with permanent marker. The clothes are a problem. Most of Miranda's office clothes come from a bargain outlet just off Young Street, and they always look okay under the dressing room lights, but by the time she gets home, they're all wrong. The black skirt shining with acrylic fibers, the blouse in a synthetic fabric that clings unpleasantly, everything cheap-looking and highly flammable. "You're an artist," her boyfriend Pablo said that morning, watching her while she tried various layering options under a blouse that had shrunk in the wash. "Why would you want to conform to some bullshit corporate dress code?"
"Because my job requires it."
"My poor corporate baby," he said, lost in the machine. Pablo talks about metaphorical machines a lot, also the man. He sometimes combines the two, as in, "That's how the man wants us, just trapped right there in the corporate machine." They met at school. Pablo graduated a year ahead of her, and at first his career seemed so brilliant that she stopped being a waitress at his invitation. He sold a painting for $10,000, and then a larger one for $21,000, and he was poised to become the next big thing. But then a show got canceled, and he sold nothing else in the year that followed. Absolutely nothing. So Miranda signed with a temp agency and found herself a short time later at her desk in a high tower outside Leon Provant's office door. "Hang in there, baby," he said that morning, watching her dress. "You know this is only temporary."
"Sure," she said.
He's been saying this ever since she registered with the temp agency. But what she hasn't told him is that she went from temporary to permanent at the end of her sixth week on the job. Leon likes her. He appreciates how calm she always is, he says, how unflappable. He even introduces her as such, on the rare occasions when he's in the office. "And this is my unflappable assistant, Miranda." This pleases her more than she likes to admit to herself. "I'm going to sell those new paintings," Pablo says. He was half naked in the bed, lying like a starfish. After she got up, he always liked to see how much of the bed he could sleep on at once. "You know there's a payday coming, right?"
"Definitely," Miranda said, giving up on the blouse and trying to find a t-shirt that might look halfway professional under her $20 blazer.
"Almost no one from that last show sold anything," he said, talking mostly to himself now.
"I know it's temporary, but this is her secret. She doesn't want it to end. What she can never tell Pablo, because he disdains all things corporate, is that she likes being at Neptune Logistics more than she likes being at home. Home is a small, dark apartment with an ever-growing population of dust bunnies, the hallway narrowed by Pablo's canvases propped up against the walls, an easel blocking the lower half of the living room window. Her workspace at Neptune Logistics is all clean lines and recessed lighting. She works on her never-ending project for hours at a time. In art school, they talked about day jobs in tones of horror. She never would have imagined that her day job would be the calmest and least cluttered part of her life. She receives 5 emails from Thea this morning, forwarded flight and hotel confirmations for Leon's upcoming trip to Asia. Miranda spends some time on the Asian travel itinerary, Japan, then Singapore, then South Korea. She likes looking up maps and imagining traveling to these places herself. She has still never left Canada. With Pablo not working or selling any paintings, she's only making minimum interest payments on her student loans, and she can barely cover their rent. She inserts the Singapore to Seoul flight information into the itinerary, double-checks the other confirmation numbers, and realizes that she's run out of tasks for the day. It's 9:45 a.m. Miranda reads the news for a while, spends some time looking at a map of the Korean Peninsula, realizes that she's been staring blankly at the screen and thinking of the world of her project, her graphic novel, her comic book series, her whatever it is that she's been working on since she graduated from art school. She retrieves her sketchbook from its hiding space under the files in her top desk drawer.
There are several important characters in the Station 11 project, but the hero is Dr. Eleven, a brilliant physicist who bears a striking physical resemblance to Pablo, but is otherwise nothing like him. He is a person from the future who never whines. He is dashing and occasionally sarcastic. He doesn't drink too much. He is afraid of nothing but has poor luck with women. He took his name from the space station where he lives. A hostile civilization from a nearby galaxy has taken control of Earth and enslaved Earth's population, but a few hundred rebels managed to steal a space station and escape. Dr. Eleven and his colleagues slipped Station 11 through a wormhole and are hiding in the uncharted reaches of deep space. This is all 1,000 years in the future. Station 11 is the size of Earth's moon and was designed to resemble a planet, but it's a planet that can chart a course through galaxies and requires no sun. The station's artificial sky was damaged in the war, however, so on Station 11's surface it is always sunset or twilight or night. There was also damage to a number of vital systems involving Station 11's ocean levels, and the only land remaining is a series of islands that once were mountaintops. There has been a schism. There are people who, after 15 years of perpetual twilight, long only to go home, to return to Earth and beg for amnesty, to take their chances under alien rule. They live in the Undersea, an interlinked network of vast fallout shelters under Station 11's oceans. There are 300 of them now. In the scene Miranda's presently sketching, Dr. Eleven is on a boat with his mentor, Captain Lonergan. Dr. Eleven. These are perilous waters. We're passing over an undersea gate. Captain Lonergan. You should try to understand them. The next panel is a close-up of his face. All they want is to see sunlight again. Can you blame them? After these two panels, she decides, she needs a full-page spread. She's already painted the image, and when she closes her eyes, she can almost see it, clipped to her easel at home. The seahorse is a massive rust-colored creature with blank eyes like saucers, half-animal, half-machine, the blue light of a radio transmitter glowing on the side of its head. Moving silent through the water, beautiful and nightmarish, a human rider from the undersea astride the curve of its spine. Deep blue water up to the top inch of the painting. On the water's surface, Dr. Eleven and Captain Lonergan in their rowboat, small under the foreign constellations of deep space. On the day she sees Arthur again, Pablo calls her on the office line in the afternoon. She's a few sips into her 4 p.m. coffee, sketching out a series of panels involving Dr. Eleven's efforts to thwart the undersea's latest plot to sabotage the station reactors and force a return to Earth. She knows as soon as she hears Pablo's voice that it's going to be a bad call. He wants to know what time she'll be home. Sometime around 8. What I don't understand, Pablo says, is what you're doing for these people. She winds the phone cord around her finger and looks at the scene she was just working on. Dr. Eleven is confronted by his undersea nemesis on a subterranean walkway by Station 11's main reactor. A thought bubble. But what insanity is this? Well, I put together Leon's travel itineraries. There have been a number of bad calls lately, and she's been trying to view them as opportunities to practice being patient. I handle his expense reports and send emails for him sometimes. There's the occasional message. I do the filing. And that takes up your entire day. Not at all. We've talked about this, Pickle. There's a lot of downtime, actually. And what do you do in that downtime, Miranda? I work on my project, Pablo. I'm not sure why your tone's so nasty. But the trouble is, she doesn't really care. There was a time when this conversation would have reduced her to tears, but now she swivels in her chair to look out at the lake and thinks about moving trucks. She could call in sick to work, pack up her things, and be gone in a few hours. It is sometimes necessary to break everything. 12-hour days, he's saying. You're never here. You're gone from 8 a.m. till 9 at night, and then you even go in on Saturdays sometimes, and I'm supposed to just, Oh, I don't know, Miranda. What would you say if you were me?
Wait, she says. I just realized why you called me on the office line.
What?
You're verifying that I'm here, aren't you? That's why you didn't call me on my cell.
A shiver of anger, unexpectedly deep. She is paying the entire rent on their apartment, and he's verifying that she's actually at her job.
The hours you work.
He lets this hang in the air till it takes on the weight of accusation.
Well, she says.
One thing she is very good at is forcing her voice to remain calm when she's angry. As I've mentioned before, Leon was very clear when he hired me. He wants me at my desk until 7 p.m. when he's traveling, and if he's here, I'm here. He texts me when he comes in on weekends, and then I have to be here too.
Oh, he texts you.
The problem is that she's colossally bored with the conversation, and also bored with Pablo, and with the kitchen on Jarvis Street where she knows he's standing because he only makes angry phone calls from home. One of the things they have in common is a mutual distaste for sidewalk weepers and cell phone screamers, for people who conduct their messier personal affairs in public. And the kitchen gets the best reception of anywhere in the apartment.
Pablo, it's just a job. We need the money.
It's always money with you, isn't it?
This is what's paying our rent. You know that, right?
Are you saying I'm not pulling my weight, Miranda? Is that what you're saying?
It isn't possible to continue to listen to this, so she sets the receiver gently on the cradle and finds herself wondering why she didn't notice earlier, say 8 years ago when they first started dating, that Pablo is mean. His email arrives within minutes. The subject header is WTF.
Miranda, it reads, what's going on here? It seems like you're being weirdly hostile and kind of passive-aggressive. What gives?
She closes it without responding and stands by the glass wall for a while to look out at the lake, imagining the water rising until it covers the streets, gondolas moving between the towers of the financial district, Dr. Eleven on a high-arched bridge. She's standing here when her cell phone rings. She doesn't recognize the number.
It's Arthur Leander, he says when she answers. Can I buy you another lunch?
How about dinner instead?
Tonight?
Are you busy?
No, he says, sitting on his bed in the Hotel Le Germain, wondering how he'll get out of dinner with the director this evening. Not at all. It would be my pleasure.
She decides it isn't necessary to call Pablo, under the circumstances. There is a small task for Leon, who is about to board a plane to Lisbon. She finds a file he needs and emails it to him and then returns to Station 11. Panels set in the undersea, people working quietly in cavernous rooms. They live out their lives under flickering lights, aware at all times of the fathoms of ocean above them, resentful of Dr. Eleven and his colleagues who keep Station 11 moving forever through deep space. Pablo texts her.
Did you get my email?
They are always waiting, the people of the undersea. They spend all their lives waiting for their lives to begin.
Miranda is drawing Leon Provence's reception area before she realizes what she's doing. The prairies of carpet, the desk, Leon's closed office door, the wall of glass, the two staplers on her desk. How did she end up with two? And the doors leading out to the elevators and restrooms. Trying to convey the serenity of this place where she spends her most pleasant hours, the refinement of it. But outside the glass wall, she substitutes another landscape, dark rocks and high bridges.
You're always half on Station 11, Pablo said during a fight a week or so ago. And I don't even understand your project. What are you actually going for here?
He has no interest in comics. He doesn't understand the difference between serious graphic novels and Saturday morning cartoons with wide-eyed Tweety birds and floppy-limbed cats. When sober, he suggests that she's squandering her talent. When drunk, he implies that there isn't much there to squander, although later he apologizes for this and sometimes cries. It's been a year and 2 months since he sold his last painting.
She started to explain her project to him again, but the words stopped in her throat.
You don't have to understand it, she said. It's mine.
The restaurant where she meets Arthur is all dark wood and soft lighting, the ceiling a series of archways and domes. I can use this, she thinks, waiting at the table for him to arrive, imagining a room like this in the undersea, a subterranean place made of wood salvaged from the station's drowned forests, wishing she had her sketchbook with her. At 8:01 p.m., a text from Pablo. I'm waiting. She turns off her phone and drops it into her handbag. Arthur comes in, breathless and apologetic, 10 minutes late. His cab got stuck in traffic.
I'm working on a comic book project, she tells him later when he asks about her work. Maybe a series of graphic novels. I don't know what it is yet.
What made you choose that form?
He seems genuinely interested. I used to read a lot of comics when I was a kid. Did you ever read Calvin and Hobbes?
Arthur is watching her closely. He looks young, she thinks, for 36. He looks only slightly older than he did when they met for lunch 7 years ago. Sure, Arthur says. I loved Calvin and Hobbes. My best friend had a stack of the books when we were growing up.
Is your friend from the island? Maybe I knew him.
Her, Victoria. She picked up and moved to Tofino 15 years ago. But you were telling me about Calvin and Hobbes.
Yes, right. Do you remember Spaceman Spiff?
She loved those panels especially. Spiff's flying saucer crossing alien skies, the little astronaut in his goggles under the saucer's glass dome. Often it was funny, but also it was beautiful. She tells him about coming back to Delano Island for Christmas in her first year of art school, after a semester marked by failure and frustrating attempts at photography. She started thumbing through an old Calvin and Hobbes and thought, this, these red desert landscapes, these skies with two moons. She began thinking about the possibilities of the form, about spaceships and stars, alien planets. But a year passed before she invented the beautiful wreckage of Station 11. Arthur watches her across the table. Dinner goes very late.
Are you still with Pablo? He asks when they're out on the street. He's hailing a cab. Certain things have been decided without either of them exactly talking about it.
We're breaking up. We're not right for each other.
Saying it aloud makes it true. They are getting into a taxi. They're kissing in the back seat. He's steering her across the lobby of the hotel with his hand on her back. She is kissing him in the elevator. She is following him into a room.
Texts from Pablo at 9, 10, and 11 p.m. Are you mad at me? Question mark, question mark? Question mark, question mark, question mark?
She replies to this. Staying with a friend tonight. We'll be home in morning, and then we can talk. Which elicits, you know what? Don't bother coming home. And she feels a peculiar giddiness when she reads this fourth text. There are thoughts of freedom and imminent escape. I could throw away almost everything, she thinks, and begin all over again. Station 11 will be my constant. At 6 in the morning, she takes a taxi home to Jarvis Street.
I want to see you tonight, Arthur whispers when she kisses him. They have plans to meet in his room after work.
The apartment is dark and silent. There are dishes piled in the sink, a frying pan on the stove with bits of food stuck to it. The bedroom door is closed. She packs two suitcases, one for clothes, one for art supplies, and is gone in 15 minutes. In the employee gym at Neptune Logistics, she showers and changes into clothes, slightly rumpled by the suitcase, meets her own gaze in the mirror while she's putting on makeup.
I repent nothing.
A line remembered from The Fog of the Internet. I am heartless, she thinks, but she knows even through her guilt that this isn't true. She knows there are traps everywhere that can make her cry.
She knows the way she dies a little every time someone asks her for change and she doesn't give it to them means that she's too soft for this world, or perhaps just for this city. She feels so small here. There are tears in her eyes now. Miranda is a person with very few certainties, but one of them is that only the dishonorable leave when things get difficult.
I don't know, Arthur says at 2 a.m. They are lying in his enormous bed at the Hotel Le Germain. He's here in Toronto for 3 more weeks and then going back to Los Angeles. She wants to believe they're lying in moonlight, but she knows the light through the window is probably mostly electric. Can you call the pursuit of happiness dishonorable? Surely sleeping with film stars when you live with someone else isn't honorable, per se. He shifts slightly in the bed, uncomfortable with the term film star, and kisses the top of her head.
I'm going to go back to the apartment in the morning to get a few more things, she says sometime around 4 a.m., half asleep, thinking about a painting she left on her easel, a seahorse rising up from the bottom of the ocean. They've been talking about plans. Things have been solidifying rapidly.
You don't think he'll do anything stupid, do you, Pablo?
No, she says. He won't do anything except maybe yell. She can't keep her eyes open.
You're sure about that?
He waits for an answer, but she's fallen asleep. He kisses her forehead. She murmurs something but doesn't wake up, and lifts the duvet to cover her bare shoulders, turns off the television, and then the light.
Chapter 15. Later, they have a house in the Hollywood Hills and a Pomeranian who shines like a little ghost when Miranda calls for her at night, a white smudge in the darkness at the end of the yard. There are photographers who follow Arthur and Miranda in the street, who keep Miranda forever anxious and on edge. Arthur's name appears above the titles of his movies now. On the night of their 3rd anniversary, his face is on billboards all over the continent. Tonight, they're having a dinner party, and Luli, their Pomeranian, is watching the proceedings from the sunroom, where she's been exiled for begging table scraps. Every time Miranda glances up from the table, she sees Luli peering in through the glass French doors. "Your dog looks like a marshmallow," says Gary Heller, who is Arthur's lawyer.
"She's the cutest little thing," Elizabeth Colton says.
Her face is next to Arthur's on the billboards, flashing a brilliant smile with very red lips. But off-screen, she wears no lipstick and seems nervous and shy. She is beautiful in a way that makes people forget what they were going to say when they look at her. She is very soft-spoken. People are forever leaning in close to hear what she's saying. There are 10 guests here tonight, an intimate evening to celebrate both the anniversary and the opening weekend figures. 2 birds with 1 stone, Arthur said. But there's something wrong with the evening, and Miranda is finding it increasingly difficult to hide her unease. Why would a 3-year wedding anniversary celebration involve anyone other than the 2 people who are actually married to one another? Who are all these extraneous people at my table? She's seated at the opposite end of the table from Arthur, and she somehow can't quite manage to catch his eye. He's talking to everyone except her. No one seems to have noticed that Miranda's saying very little. "I wish you'd try a little harder," Arthur has said to her once or twice, but she knows she'll never belong here, no matter how hard she tries. These are not her people. She is marooned on a strange planet. The best she can do is pretend to be unflappable when she isn't. Plates and bottles are being ferried to and from the table by a small army of caterers who will leave their headshots and possibly a screenplay or two behind in the kitchen at the end of the night. Luli, on the wrong side of the glass, is staring at a strawberry that's fallen off the top of Heller's wife's dessert. Miranda has a poor memory when she's nervous, which is to say, whenever she has to meet industry people, or throw a dinner party, or especially both, and she absolutely cannot remember Heller's wife's name, although she's heard it at least twice this evening.
Oh, it was intense, Heller's wife is saying now, in response to something that Miranda didn't hear. We were out there for a week, just surfing every day. It was actually really spiritual.
The surfing? The producer seated beside her asks.
You wouldn't think it, right? But just going out every day, just you and the waves and a private instructor, it was just a really focused experience. Do you surf?
I'd love to, but I've just been so busy with this whole school thing lately, the producer says. Actually, I guess you'd maybe call it an orphanage. It's this little thing I set up in Haiti last year. But the point is education, not just housing these kids.
I don't know. I'm not attached to his project or anything.
Arthur is deep in conversation with an actor who played his brother in a film last year. I've never met the guy, but I've heard through friends that he likes my work. I've met him a few times, the actor says.
Miranda tunes out the overlapping conversations to look at Luli, who's looking at her through the glass. She'd like to take Luli outside and stay in the backyard with her until all these people leave.
The dessert plates are cleared around midnight, but no one's close to leaving, a wine-drenched languor settling over the table. Arthur is deep in conversation with Heller. Heller's nameless wife is gazing dreamily at the chandelier. Clark Thompson is here, Arthur's oldest friend and the only person at this table, aside from Miranda, who has no professional involvement in movies.
I'm sorry, a woman named Tesh is saying now to Clark. What exactly is it that you do?
Tesh seems to be someone who mistakes rudeness for intellectual rigor. She is about 40 and wears severe black-framed glasses that somehow remind Miranda of architects. Miranda met her for the first time this evening, and she can't remember what Tesh does, except that obviously she's involved in some way with the industry. A film editor, maybe? And also Miranda doesn't understand Tesh's name. Is she Tesh something or something Tesh? Or a one-namer like Madonna? Are you allowed to have only one name if you're not famous? Is it possible that Tesh is actually extremely famous and Miranda's the only one at the table who doesn't know this? Yes, that seems very possible. These are the things she frets about.
What do I do?
Nothing terribly glamorous, I'm afraid.
Clark is British, thin and very tall, elegant in his usual uniform of vintage suit and Converse sneakers, accessorized with pink socks. He brought them a gift tonight, a beautiful glass paperweight from a museum gift shop in Rome.
I have nothing to do with the film industry, he says.
Oh, Heller's wife says, I think that's marvelous.
It's certainly exotic, Tesh says. But that doesn't narrow the field much, does it?
Management consulting, based out of New York, new client in Los Angeles. I specialize in the repair and maintenance of faulty executives.
Clark sips his wine.
And what's that in English?
The premise of the company by which I'm employed, Clark says, is that if one's the employer of an executive who's worthy in some ways but deeply flawed in others, it's sometimes cheaper to fix the executive than to replace him, or her.
He's an organizational psychologist, Arthur says, surfacing from conversation at the far end of the table. I remember when he went back to England to get his PhD.
A PhD, Tesh says. How conventional. And you?
She's turned to Miranda. How's your work going?
It's going very well, thank you.
Miranda spends most of her time working on the Station 11 project. She knows from the gossip blogs that people here see her as an eccentric, the actor's wife who inks mysterious cartoons that no one's ever laid eyes on. My wife's very private about her work, Arthur says in interviews, and who doesn't drive and likes to go for long walks in a town where nobody walks anywhere, and who has no friends except a Pomeranian. Although does anyone really know this last part? She hopes not. Her friendlessness is never mentioned in gossip blogs, which she appreciates. She hopes she isn't as awkward to other people as she feels to herself. Elizabeth Colton is looking at her again in that golden way of hers. Elizabeth's